connecting community through business, building relationships, and building Waterloo Region. 570 News presents Business to Business, powered by Cowan Insurance Group. Here are your hosts, Ian McLean of the KW Chamber of Commerce and Greg DeRocher of the Cambridge Chamber of Commerce.
Welcome to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance, joined in studio by my good friend Greg DeRocher, President and CEO of the Cambridge Chamber of Commerce, Luke Schultz, who is the executive producer of Business to Business. We are under tight time constraints right now.
Is that why you're talking so fast?
Yes, that's why I'm trying to talk so fast here. We have two great interviews today. We're doing the second with Chuck Howitt on his book, Blackberry Town, which was a...
So why are you rushing through this?
Well, because we only got 3 minutes to do this opening segment. And then we're joined in the third segment by Josh Van Dyke, and he is the manager of the small business group at BDC. Greg, we have... They're great interviews. Yep. You're going to enjoy it. But just quickly before we go to a quick break and come back with Chuck, big news, I guess the thing we should cover in this segment is the federal cabinet was announced on... Wednesday.
Yeah, finally. And you know, you might understand the timeline a little bit. Did it seem like a long time since the election before the cabinet?
A little longer. Usually it's maybe a week. It's two to three weeks to get organized, even if it's a returning government. But it was a little longer. Yeah. I think that was the complication of having no members in Alberta and Saskatchewan.
I think you're probably right. I think it was great to hear that one of our own here in the region, Waterloo, are going to remain in cabinet. Yep. That's Bartosz Chagger. She's going to be
Minister of Diversity,
Inclusion and Youth.
Yep. That's just great.
I think that's fantastic. You know, it's interesting. I think Chrystia Freeland's going to be really interesting, a different role for her now. Mm-hmm. And in a minority government, I think, you know, you're probably going to see the deputy prime minister, which she is also going to be, is going to have a little bit more power. Because when we talked to Perrin a week or so ago, he was all about that. What happens in a minority government? The power comes out of the PMO and more into the MP's
role.
It's
also going to be more domestic in nature. So we got the trade deals and everything else, which is focused on the last, but they're going to have to be focused more on domestic the economy and domestic issues, because the election's probably within 24 months.
There was some chat going around too yesterday, and just maybe a quick comment on this, that there seemed to be a tremendous number of ministers from Quebec.
Well, there's 17 from Ontario and I think 11 from Quebec.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very heavily, you know, that's also, when you don't have members from Alberta and Saskatchewan.
No, I know, but I think that might bend the Alberta or the West's nose out of joint just a tiny little bit. But
They're certainly going to have focus. I would preview that we've talked to our good friend J.D. Bellavos. Yep. He's going to come on the next couple of weeks, I think in early December, when we have the throne speech, the new cabinet, and he will speak. Spent a couple of segments with him really drilling down on this, but we are really tight on time today. It was a fascinating discussion. I know you were down at the Ontario Economic Summit. Yep. Just 30 seconds on the summit from last week.
It was absolutely fantastic. We had David Frum, of course, who brought a real interesting conversation around the U.S. elections and the impeachment trial and all of that, but also brought it back home to Canada. And I think it was interesting, his commentary, but still the best one was Vasi Kapelos and our own Perrin Beattie. Yeah. Perrin really opened up and talked a lot about, because he served in minority governments as well, really understands the dynamics and difference between minority and majority. And I think it's going to be an interesting play. He suspects it'll probably go 2 years, but likely not any longer than that.
Well, it's going to be interesting. We'll be watching that. Listen, we're going to go to a quick break. On the other side of the break, we're going to be joined by Chuck Howitt, and he is the author, retired reporter for the Waterloo Region Record, but the author of Blackberry Town, and it's the second in our two-part interview on what is a fascinating book. We'll be back with more on Business to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance, right after the break.
Business to Business, powered by Cowan Insurance Group, a presentation of 570 News. We'll return with more Business to Business. Now, back to Business, powered by Cowan Insurance Group on 570 News.
Welcome back to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance. And this segment is brought to you by our friends at BDC. Of course, BDC is Canada's only bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs. And I'm very pleased to have back Chuck Howitt. He, of course, is a retired business reporter with the Waterloo Region Record. An old acquaintance of mine, but he, more importantly, is the author of a new book called Blackberry Town, telling the story of high-tech success here in the Waterloo region and focused around the BlackBerry story. So welcome back to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, one of the things, and I should point out, this book, it's a great read. If you have not got it, go to one of our local bookstores like Wordsworth or Indigo, or you can get it online. It's worth getting a copy for yourself, because it's not just about BlackBerry. It's about the community, and it's about the things that led to its rise and what came when it had its downturn and where it is now and what it's produced here in the region of Waterloo. So it's a fantastic read. Last week, Chuck, we talked about sort of the pieces that were in place, that all the ingredients, if you will. Mike Lazaridis is coming to go to computer science at U of W. The intellectual property policy at the University of Waterloo, that the creator owns the content. That there was a number of things here in the community that would, you know, as you say, put the ingredients in the pot and the magic happened. So there was, we talked about that. Let's talk a little bit more into the guts of the story. What was the thing? What was the one or two things that produced the shot to the moon? Because when this took off, and people don't remember, there were very few cell phones up until this point. This was the first consumer accessible cell phone email device when it first came out. What were the things that produced getting to that spot where all of a sudden this went from, in the early days, it was research in motion, no one knew what it was, and then all of a sudden, oh my goodness, everyone's got to have a BlackBerry in their hands.
Yeah, well, there were a number of steps that happened, and this would have been in the early to mid-90s. I think RIM, Mike Lazaridis, always wanted to connect wireless with computers, and that goes back to his high school days in Windsor. But RIM was largely an engineering company in the 90s, and basically what happened was they heard about this mobile texting service that came from Sweden called Mobitex. And Ted Rogers really linked it all up. He heard about Mobitex. He came back to Canada and thought, well, I've got to get this into sort of our pagers and stuff like that. And so he looked around for somebody that knew something about that, and he heard about RIM in Waterloo. So he contacted them and hired them to help him sort of get Mobitex into motion in Canada. And so Mike Lazaridis and his crew started working on some of that stuff. And really what they were doing, they were also doing products like putting little things that went into laptops to connect up wirelessly with things. And they were building modems for Rogers for the Mobitex network, but they were all kind of unhappy with
being in the hardware side.
The modems, Ericsson was owned Mobitex and they were providing the modems, but RIM wasn't happy with them. They didn't work very well, so they decided, let's build our own modems. And just to simplify it, they were also building these computer cards that went into laptops. They decided, why don't we just take this computer card and build our own device? We'll slap it into this brick-like structure and put the modem in there. And that's how they came up with the first interactive pager 900. Now, they also needed the cooperation of Intel, because RIM didn't make integrated circuits or processors. Mm-hmm. So they got Intel involved, their Arizona arm, and that's a whole story in itself.
But they put all of these pieces together and produced what was effectively, the first ones were pagers. They were glorified pagers. They didn't have the phone on them, but they would do, it was interactive. You could reply back, but it took all those pieces together. It was drawing all those pieces together and then doing the next step.
Right, yeah. So the other thing that happened was there were carriers that were looking for something new to put on their networks, and Bell South in the United States had bought the right to Mobitex in the U.S., so they were looking for something to put on the network, and so they heard about RIM. So RIM produced the first interactive pager 900, which got good reviews, but it didn't sell that well. It was kind of a clamshell device. It was kind of bulky and cumbersome. So they got good reviews, but it didn't sell. So then they came up with the pager 950, which was kind of a candy bar-like horizontal device. And they went down to Atlanta. This is a really has become a famous story in RIM lore, where they went down to Bell South headquarters in Atlanta, and it's in the other books too, where Bell South basically told them, all right, you know, we want to know what you're doing. If you can't produce something, we're going to sell the Mobitex network and get out of it. So Lazarides and Balzilli went down there and put on a presentation. They left the devices in a taxi. It was almost a disaster. Somebody had to retrieve them. So they brought the devices in, and Lazarides made this presentation, and everybody was just blown away and thought, wow, this is the future. So they signed the big deal contract with Bell South, and that was really what enabled the BlackBerry to start to take off. And then it was, so they got the big contract, excuse me, and they, Balzilli kind of kicked in with his guerrilla sales tactics.
Yeah.
And they kind of went to Wall Street and big legal firms, and that's, their timing couldn't have been better, really. It was 99, 2000, 98, 99, 2000. That's when all that happened. So it was a dual
effort. Perfect storm.
Yeah.
People were ready for new technology. They had something which was new and fresh. But I think from that point forward, the evolution, because it grew both in market share, because when they eventually went public, it went off like a rocket. But the investors were seeing that they had to keep getting that next generation and keep getting it smaller and getting more features. They added in, I don't know, sometime early 2000s with phones that actually worked.
The voice
side of things. I remember, because I can safely say, from the first time I had one of the scroll pagers, one of the first ones that actually worked, and I've had every device, because I'm a diehard BlackBerry. I still have the key too. But they were coming out fast and furious. Every 2 or 3 months, there would be a new device, and it would be there would be adding those features. That must have been, I mean, is that what really put it on the map, that they had that technology, and then they kept getting better, sexier devices that were more user-friendly? Is that part of what really sent them on that meteoric rise?
Yes, I would say that was definitely part of it. They kept improving on the BlackBerry, adding features like voice and a bigger screen, icons like email. Of course, they had email attachments. You could even surf the internet in a rudimentary way. So they essentially really cornered the market with the business. They started in the business market, and they nailed it down with large corporations, and nobody else could really match what they were doing. I believe it's important to continually refresh and improve your device. So they really, that's what sort of paved the way as well.
And, you know, I think as much as anything in those early days, I mean, Lazarides was the brains on the technology. Balzilli was the one that was doing the marketing and doing those product placements in movies where people would wander around and you'd see the BlackBerry, and they switched it to the BlackBerry, and seeing those devices in movies and in hands of presidents, et cetera. And there was a big marketing component to this, but they were not the only game in town, but they were the dominant market force in these new types of devices. And that was as much marketing as it was the technology was keeping up, and they were having new things. What led to the fall from those tremendous heights? Because it grew from, you know, Jim and Mike and a couple of people and Doug Fragan to 25,000. I mean, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of employees right across the globe, and heavy concentration here. What led to the downfall? What were the pieces where they fell short, and because they're you know, it was pretty fast fall as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say it was really a combination of factors, both inside and outside the company. Inside the company, I think they got a bit complacent. They had fended off all comers prior to that, and like a lot of people think, the iPhone was just came along out of the blue and was the first BlackBerry killer. No, there were a number of potential threats leading up to 2007 when the iPhone came out. So there were other threats, and they had fended them all off. So I think they thought they were a bit invincible, and so they got sort of complacent. The next big frontier was breaking into the consumer market, and RIM talked about that a lot, but they just kind of took baby steps in that direction. And
because in those days, it was big companies. I worked for a big company like Labatt's, and Labatt's would say, okay, we want to get 3,000 phones because they all wanted to be on the same market. Yeah. We don't need to go into it, but you had to have a BlackBerry server, and there were a whole bunch of reasons, which was both good and bad. But it was primarily enterprise. Like, it was business. And they didn't really go into that consumer market. And then it all sort of switched in, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, where suddenly it became the consumer was where the market was. And and companies saying, well, people don't want to take my company, my Greater KW Chamber phone, because they already got their own. And that's where you started seeing some of that, where it started to move quickly to the consumer market.
Right. Bring your own device sort of became the slogan around that time. But I think what also changed, there was a lot that was changing in around 2005 and 6. Like, prior to that, phones there weren't processors around to do the fancy stuff that was on the iPhone. And it was only in that period that they were becoming powerful enough that they could do that kind of thing. And so that's where Apple sort of capitalized on that. We're able to put a Mac OS into a phone, whereas RIM really didn't. Mike Lazaridis was always concerned about conserving bandwidth, so he wasn't really thinking, let's put a big, powerful processor and make a big leap. He didn't, because the networks didn't really want him to do that, but Apple got a special deal from AT&T, so they were able to do that, and so they leapt ahead. And then RIM was always from that point in catch-up mode, which they were never able to do. The other problem with RIM was they were working with an old operating system from the original BlackBerries, so they needed to sort of build a new OS to handle these more powerful devices. And they started on that kind of late when they acquired QNX in 2010. And the phones with that QNX system didn't come out to 2013. So too late, really.
Yeah, we were already on the downside. Yeah. We can talk. The people can read about those parts of the downturn. I'm more interested because I think this book is as much about anything about what's left in the wake of that story that you tell, which is a much stronger tech community. I mean, we talk about Communitech, and we know the work that they do. But there are other tremendous success stories here that weren't directly related, but I think were sustained and emboldened and grew because of what BlackBerry brought. BlackBerry put us on the map globally. It put this region as being a leader in tech. But there are other companies. You talk maybe a little bit about OpenText. There was other companies like Pickstream that came here. We can rhyme the list now. I mean, MyoVision now and Desire to Learn, Exonify. There are tons and tons of companies that are here because there was this hotbed of technology here. Talk a little bit about that part of the other side of the story, which was what BlackBerry produced in the long term.
Yeah, well, I think there was more to the tech community than just BlackBerry. I mean, BlackBerry was kind of an anchor. It gave the tech sector a halo effect, attracted a lot of attention here. And so that was good. But since BlackBerry's shrunk and declined, I think the risk has been spread over a broader number of companies rather than just having one way up shining star and then a bunch of others down below. So the risk has been spread over a number of companies. And I think the tech sector has weathered the storm of the decline of BlackBerry and is still going pretty strong. I mean, Waterloo is recognized around the world as being one of the best, I call it the best little tech sectors in Canada. Like, one of the things that happened, kind of a silver lining, as I say in the book, is that a number of BlackBerry employees left and started other companies or went to work for other companies. And some of them that I've listed in the book include Avic Networks, Magnet Forensics, Swift Labs, Cognitive Systems, Izera Corporation. They're involved in quantum computing. Mike Lazaridis has taken up the torch, and now his big new cause is quantum computing.
Yeah, Institute for Quantum Computing.
He's attracted a lot of investment here. He invests in quantum startups. So there's a lot of positive things that came out of the BlackBerry sort of decline. And BlackBerry itself is still around as a solid company in the community, you know, working on encryption and connected car, Internet of Things. So they're still there. And there's companies like OpenText, which have always been around. Their story is a fascinating one, by the way. And I focus on the rise of OpenText earlier in the book. And they're still rock solid.
Business. Canada's largest software company right here in the region of Waterloo. It is fascinating. You mentioned AVIC. I think it just won an award this week as one of CAS's, Canada's fastest growing tech companies. In fact, it might be the number one. I mean, there are, and I think that's for those, because some of our listeners may be newer to Waterloo region. Watching BlackBerry grow in real time, and you had a front row seat as a business reporter, it was kind of almost unbelievable that this was happening in Waterloo region. Even though we are all excited about this, the fact that in a global context, BlackBerry was being talked about in Waterloo region, was being talked about in New York and in Europe and in Asia, all over the world, and it was produces, and what we have now is that community of technology that is with startups and all of those companies across different sectors in technology. And a lot of it is driven by what at least people started to think about our region because of BlackBerry, in addition to all U of W and other things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's no question it was a special time. I mean, you don't get companies like RIM coming along. It happens once in a generation.
Yeah.
And I would argue that what they created, like, it was pretty important. I mean, when you look at the iPhone now, it's really just there's slight improvements, but really it hasn't changed dramatically since 2007. And so the creation of the smartphone was a pretty big deal, and RIM was right in there on the ground floor, and it happened right here in Waterloo. I remember when I first started covering business in 2005, I couldn't believe it. I had not paid close attention to RIM prior to that. And I was astounded at what they had accomplished. And when I really drilled down to look at what these guys had done, it was pretty impressive stuff. And I talk about that a bit in the book, about the impact on the community and so on. So I tried to capture some of that.
Well, no, it's a fascinating read. And again, for those that haven't got their hands on a copy, do yourself a favor. It's a great, it tells a great community story as well as a tech story and the BlackBerry story. And I think in that order, there's lots to chew on there. But you can find this book. It's called BlackBerry Town by Chuck Howitt. You can find it on at Indigo bookstores, Wordsworth here in Uptown Waterloo, online, on Amazon or other places. Do yourself a favor and get that. It's a fabulous read, and we appreciate you coming in and sharing that story, because I think what I wouldn't want anyone to think about is BlackBerry is a success story through and through, even through the ups and downs, because it has been and continues to be a leader and a part of the building block of the growth of this region. Thanks for writing the book.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, Ian. Great to be here.
All right, we've been joined by Chuck Howitt. He, of course, is a retired reporter with the Waterloo Region Record, but more importantly, he is the author of BlackBerry Town, How High-Tech Success Has Played Out for Canada's Kitchener-Waterloo. We'll be back with more on Business to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance, right after the break.
You're listening to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance. You're listening to Business, powered by Cowan Insurance Group, featuring local businesses, solutions, and success stories, connecting community through business on 570 News.
Welcome back to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance. And this segment is brought to you by our friends at BDO Kitchener-Waterloo. Of course, BDO provides accounting, audit, and advisory services, particularly for small and medium-sized enterprise here in the Waterloo region across southwestern Ontario. And we're joined by our good friend, Josh Van Dyke. And, of course, he is the manager of the small business team with BDC in Kitchener-Waterloo. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we had you on, I think the last time it was Kirk Irving was here, yep. And you came to just get a feel for how we do things on the show.
Just wanted to make sure there was some structure and organization.
You knew what was
here.
Going on. But we, but then
see
we
where that bar was set.
That's right.
Luke is shaking his head. No,
but we wanted to let you pick a topic that you thought was important yeah. for your customers, because many of our businesses would benefit from what the topic we're going to talk about today, Greg. And you have a little experience in this because you had your own business and you eventually sold your own business. Yep. And what we're going to talk about today is what are the things you need to do when you're getting ready to sell your own business?
Well, and I think it's, first of all, it's kind of a mindset thing, but often there's a lot more into it. So an individual might say, yes, I'm ready to sell my business. I'm ready to retire and trail off into the sunset. But that might not be the only reason or the only thing you need to consider when is the right time. So, Josh, why don't you kind of step us through that first? How do you know when it's a good time to sell your business?
Well, you tackled a couple of my points already there. But, I mean, the first off, you have to, is my company ready, right? So you want to consider the external factors, right, that affect your business, including market conditions, technologies that are out there, regulations or geopolitical events, what foreign trade agreements can be out there. Obviously, we have some people to the south that can impact us greatly. Mm-hmm. So, and then whether your company's in good financial shape, right? So that means history of profitability, strong balance sheet, lean processes, and a good customer base, mm-hmm. as well as obviously the ability for future growth.
But I think it's important, you know, to really focus on this and get some advice on this as to when the right time is, because you don't want to put yourself in a position where, oh, gee, December 31st, I want to be out of here. Now that the pressure's on, and so your negotiation tax and your ability to be able to get the most out of it is probably not there because you've already set the deadline.
Exactly, and then it depends on, like, who's involved in the transaction. And, I mean, when you talk about the price on it and when to sell, there's probably, you can't rush the situation. Mm-hmm. And it's not all about the price either. It's got to be the right buyer because that can impact the amount of time you spend on a transaction. You spend a lot of time going through this, mm-hmm. and deals do fall away at the due diligence stage. So finding the right buyer can also impact the amount of cash you get up front, or even tax planning if it's estate planning within your family.
I think one of the things is timing is a big one. So if you say, I'd like to be out in a year or 15 months or 2 years or 6 months, putting that timeline on can really affect, because you want to maximize the value. And you talked about some of the things earlier. How do you know that your balance sheet is clean? You've got good, you know, POs or customers or orders coming in, because all of those things will be captured in the valuation. So for many small businesses that start, you're growing your business, you've grown it to a certain level, maximizing, which in a lot of cases, Greg, when you're in a family-owned business, your business is your retirement. So maximizing it when you're ready to get out in a lot of cases is important. So, you know, maybe talk a little bit about who are the folks that you should be talking to. Obviously, BDC and your advisory services would be a great source of saying, here are the things, here's the to-do list, but your accountant, your lawyer, you got to go through all of those pieces. But a good place to start would be BDC saying, here is the to-do list in order to get ready to maximize the value of your company.
So, yeah, obviously, you never want to go in and be like, okay, I want to retire this year. Right? But an incoming buyer wants to see a history of stable profits, or at least stable revenues with some decent profitability in the short term, with the potential for more in the long term, depending on what the management team looks like. But you definitely want to plan ahead. We talked about that in the previous segment, is the most important thing you can do. You want at least 3 to 5 years of history. I mean, the tech sector is its own. They're building it up for sale quickly, and they don't have a history of profits, right? But in a general sense, if you don't have a company with the stabilized profits and you've taken money out and the retained earnings aren't there, it doesn't show an incoming buyer that you're maybe at the point where...
So, Greg, when you were getting ready to sell, you were in the insurance business. Yep. Whoever you were selling it to would do their due diligence. I think that's what you're talking about, Josh. They're going to do their due diligence and say, how long have you been in business? What's your profits on a yearly basis? Who is the staff or that will be buying along with the company? I mean, those are some of the things that folks like you and your team at in the Small Business Center at BDC can be helpful with.
Yeah,
absolutely. Like, at the end of the day, the banks aren't going to help you structure a transaction in front of stakeholders to sit with you at the table, but they can be a huge advocate for you in terms of introducing you to the right people, whether that's business brokers, the right accounting firm. There's a lot of mom and pop accounting firms out there that are very good at what they do, but they maybe don't have the history or the depth of knowledge that the BEOs of the world might, that would be able to provide that extra layer of advice in terms of the valuation sector, or even being able to sit with you at the table at a transaction and knowing what aspects that you can pull to maximize the value.
I think it's really important to understand that, you know, this is maybe the most important decision that a business owner is going to make in their, you know, it's the rest of their life, really. And I think it's really important you make sure that you get the professional help around you that has knowledge maybe on your business sector or and expertise in that area to be able to determine accurately what the valuation is. But what I find is interesting is sometimes, you know, small and medium-sized businesses, maybe it's a family transition. So, you know, this stuff has kind of always... you know, probably for 10 years or so has kind of been
slowly
the end
coming
result.
Up.
Yeah, it's always going to happen that way. However, if that's not the situation, now what you want to do is you're 3 to 5 years out. You're maybe that's the kind of planning window that you want to have. Now maybe what you want to do is you want to really maximize the value of your business. So this gives you some runway to be able to say, how do I increase the value of my business? And so what are those steps that that businesses need to concentrate on or owners need to concentrate on to get to that point?
Well, one would be obviously boosting your profits, but that's going to come through increasing sales and leaning up your processes, right? So having redundant processes, getting your contracts in check with your employees, customers, suppliers, right? So that part of the business is stabilized. But you talked on it, like the employee part of it, finding the right employees is so tough in today's environment, right? So to be able to do that, you want to make sure that you're training, motivating, and empowering your people, right? A strong professional team will add a ton of value to your business, and companies with few tangible assets, that becomes ever much more important.
Yeah, I think you almost want to kind of get to the point where, maybe not totally, but the business doesn't need me, right? So you build a professional enough framework around your employee base and your operations that, you know what, if you're kind of out of the way, maybe that's not going to impact or decrease the value of the business. So the more you can take away that kind of the personal thing, I talked to a lady this past week who is in that situation where she doesn't have anything to sell because she is the business.
100%.
So, you know, now what she needs to do is kind of move in the direction of saying, I got to take me.
Take the knowledge and you.
The people out of it and make
well,
it about
that,
the organization.
Isn't that part of it, Josh? The valuation for each individual business is different. It may be the people. It may be the product. It may be the supply chain. It may be the contracts that you have or some combination of all of those pieces. But I guess that's the question. What are those pieces that you need to kind of get in shape when you say, when someone's going to value, I mean, Greg, you had a business, you would have gone through and said, here's what we think it's worth.
Yep.
Someone on the other side of the transaction is going to come in and say, they're going to test that. They're going to do their own valuation. And that's when the negotiation starts. Mm-hmm. But what are some of those pieces that you would need to, and I think you've talked about them, but
document your processes, right? Is one key one. Financial statements, minute books, customer and supplier contracts, and then just a list of the assets or what the goodwill means to the organization and the marketplace, right?
And that's the brand of your company.
The brand of your company.
ABC Rental Company. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to the person that's buying it?
And a lot of people work within their business. They know the industry very well, and they hear about multiples of or companies selling for multiples, but it's a separate industry, right?
Yeah.
And then you have to go beyond that to have that next conversation ahead of time with your accountant or anybody else that might have that, and whether that's the BDC where we can pull some stats for you and really learn what that industry looks like and what it values and what's going to create value for your company moving forward.
I think it's such an important subject, and I was so impressed with this individual that I met this past week who is going through that process and thinking her window though is like 10 years down the road, but she's saying right now what I have to do is I have to create my company so that my company's not me. that my company is a standalone business that's that anybody can come in and kind of take over. And I think that's very wise planning from her perspective, and something that oftentimes it's really hard. If you started the business, it's your baby, right? Yeah. You want to be involved with every aspect of it. And you want to make it you. And really, if you want to have that commodity at the end of the day, you need to figure out how it exists without you.
Just in the last couple of minutes, what are some of the do's and don'ts? Like maybe going to sort of the checklist, like you've talked about something. Give yourself the runway to clean up your books, to get your contracts and some of those basic pieces in place, because that's the guts of the... What are some of the other do's and don'ts as you get ready to get to that point of putting it on the market and engaging with another the other side of that business transaction?
I would say a big one is going to be don't let your emotions get the best of you. This is going to be one of the most emotional pieces of it, right? The seller always feels like they're getting ripped off, and the buyer always feels like they're getting ripped off. And you have to remember, it's a negotiation. You've come to the table kind of trying to
come to
an agreement, right? And then you get to the nitty-gritty of it. And especially when it's family, right? You have to deal with the softer sides of relationships and managing, okay, who's going to be the president? Who's going to be a VP of sales, right? And then what does that look like? So then using your like strategic plan to kind of map out what those milestones need to look like, who's going to be responsible for what, and try to manage those relationships can be very difficult.
You know, Greg, this is one of the reasons why we're so pleased to have BDC as, as one of our partners, along with BDO, is bringing this show to folks. Is you've got a wealth of opportunity for any business that's listening here, whether they're a chamber member or not, to go to BDC, because you have not only the banking side, because you are Canada's only bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, and I know that, but you also have advisory services on the business side of things. And I think that's a lot of what you're talking about today, is there's the banking side, but there's also those other services that you should get advice from. And BDC is one of those great partners.
Yeah, absolutely. So we offer a suite of services. There's other services available in the marketplace, but we try and take the knowledge-based approach where we're teaching the entrepreneur, not just doing it for them, right? So that way they can build it internally. So whether that's anything from HR planning, which can be very intangible, working with them to create job descriptions, organizational charts, onboarding processes, et cetera, down to strategic planning. So it can be a formula of succession planning or for succession planning, but really it's helped to map out. None of it's mind-blowing stuff that you can't find information on, but entrepreneurs get caught up too often in, oh, I don't have time for this to work on my business.
To work on the planning side.
But and I think a lot of them realize it, but they don't pull themselves out and they're like, oh, I don't have time for this.
Gotta get
right
out of your own.
But there never really is a right time. Like there's always going to be that next project on the go, right?
Well, and I think this is one of the, you got to get out of your own way. And part of that is knowing when you've got to put time into something that isn't the day-to-day operations. Because as you get ready to sell, you're going to have to do that planning. And a good place to start is with BDC.
And it adds value at the end of the day, right? Because it forces you to delegate tasks to some of your, and formulate procedures that are in place, and will end up adding value to the sale price at the end of the day, even though it's taking them out from that initial sale that they're running with right now. So that's always important. And then I would say that planning ahead piece gets you mentally prepared that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah,
the psychological readiness of the entrepreneur when they have a plan, or they've kind of have some guidelines, milestones, checkpoints in place, it indirectly takes them out of the business a little bit sooner and gets them ready for that transaction.
Yeah. Listen, hard thing to go through if you're, you know, the founder of the company especially, but a well and strategic plan to get there will make you feel better about it, and it'll get you the maximum you can.
Well, great information, and I guess the theme here is you gotta ask for your advisors and the people that support you to get the information and everything packaged together so you do maximize that huge asset that you've built over time. And a great place to go is to start the process, because you may not be able to do it all BDC, but it's a place to start. Yep. Right away.
Give Josh a call right now.
If you're selling, call Josh right now. He is the manager with the small business team at BDC and KW, and he can help you with everything you need to know about selling your business. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, we'll be back with more on Business to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance, right after the break.
Business to Business, powered by Cowan Insurance Group, a presentation of 570 News. We'll return with more Business to Business. It's not just what you know, it's who you know. This is Business to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance Group.
Welcome back to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance, and joined again in studio this week by Teresa Norris-Lew. She, of course, is the Vice President of Pension and Retirement Consulting at Cowan Insurance Group. Gregory, we talked last week about getting ready for retirement. We talked about more of the personal or the financial aspects of it.
The treasury side of it.
This is the most interesting. Yeah. So the financial and your CPP and OAS and your personal savings and all the things we touched on with Teresa last week. But there's another aspect to this, mm-hmm. which I think is really important and the Cowan folks wanted to bring to our listeners' attention mm-hmm. is, emotionally getting ready to retire.
Oh, man.
Because that's
I think it could be the biggest one, Teresa. It could be the whole emotional. You know, I think, you know, obviously finances are really important. And maybe once you got it kind of in your head, oh, yeah, my finances are okay. I've got some assets I can sell. I've got a retirement pension. I've got CPP. I've got all those things. They're going to help me along. But now what am I going to do the next day? When you're 35... and you buy a lottery ticket and say, when I win the millions of dollars this weekend, I can't wait to go in and quit. That's a totally different thing because you're 35 and life is just going to be fun with all bags of money. Now you're thinking about actual real retirement. What are some of the things people start thinking about or start panicking about when that is inevitable?
It's interesting because oftentimes people will think, wow, I'm going to go on vacation and I'm going to get all those things down around the house that I can never get done. And my response to that is, okay, you might be on vacation a couple of weeks a year if you're lucky, and you probably get all those to-do jobs done in the first month that you retire. So then what, right? It's thinking about, how am I going to spend my time now that I'm out of routine of getting up and going to work, if that was your routine? What is my new routine going to be? What's my new normal going to be? And who am I going to be when I can't tie my identity to my career anymore? And those are some very, you know, as you've said, Greg, those are things that people don't give enough thought to, that part of the plan. They think, okay, I'm financially ready, but they haven't thought about, what am I going to do? They haven't thought about, you know, are my partner and I on the same page about what we're going to do?
Yeah.
Do I want to be with my partner 24/7 if that's part of the plan? Like, they haven't thought of those sorts of aspects of retirement.
Well, so, we all often talk about that. I remember when Ken Sealing was, you know, and I hate to use people, but I'll use Ken because he's a public figure. But, you know, and I used to say to him, well, how does Kathy feel about your retirement? And he would say, well, we don't know that yet. You know, we don't know that yet. But it is. It's an adjustment. It's a psychological and mental adjustment all the way around, not just for you, but for your spouse or others in your family, you know, and your identity. I never thought about the identity thing, you know.
Well, so how do you work with or what are some of the tools that you would recommend to your clients when you're working with folks at Cowan, your customers at Cowan, to get them prepared, to get them thinking about that? Because I suspect you're right. People say, oh, it's great. You know, you think about the great month-long vacation you're going to go on and say, well, you're not on vacation 11 months of the year, so what are you going to do in those other times? What are some of the tools or what's some of the ways you get people to start thinking about that?
So it's interesting because we have looked at one stat where a conference board says that over 90% of organizations will help their employees with some of those financial aspects, whether that's through, you know, lunch and learns, group education sessions, one-on-one opportunity, but less than 50% spend any time on this at all. So what we're recommending more and more is that as you're doing those education pieces for financial literacy and financial knowledge for your employees, that you also, when you're getting into those preparing for retirement conversations, whether that's group education sessions, lunch and learns, one-on-ones, you also include some of those psychological aspects and get people to start thinking about, you know, from that side of it, what are things going to look like for me when I retire?
You know, and I think that's interesting. I mean, more and more not-for-profits and community groups need people to volunteer. And a great resource is those that have been successful in business or in their working careers that may have time on their hands. And those are some of the things that I think people should be thinking about, is there's lots of ways to fill your time where you can still make a contribution that isn't tied to your work working life, but it may be your community life.
That's exactly right. And that's filling that social piece that sometimes we don't realize there is that social component to work. And so how do we replace that social component? And I once talked to a gentleman, actually quite a sad story, who had a fairly big job all of his life. And when he made the decision to retire, he didn't realize that 95% of his relationships were tied to the people that he worked with and his colleagues and his clients. So he actually went through a fairly serious depression because he hadn't thought about enough of these things before, before plunging.
Yeah. Well, and I think you think of a lot of professionals who are really engaged in what they do. They love what they're doing, but they don't have a hobby. They don't, you know, because they're so concentrating on the objective of their routine at work that they don't develop other things in their lives. And all of a sudden now you shut that off. What do you do?
Yeah. Even if you think about the intellectual pieces of our work and our career, right? You also have to think about how am I going to replace those pieces as well, you know, take up more reading, take classes, do whatever, but just, you know, intellectual, social, all of those things are important considerations.
Yeah. Well, and this has been important and appreciate you coming in the last couple of weeks because the financial side, which we covered last week, is really critical. So that you are prepared from a financial perspective, but I don't think this gets talked about nearly enough. And so the professionals that work with you and your pension and retirement consulting practice will be able to talk about both sides of this, both the financial as well as the preparing yourself emotionally or personally. And I think that's an important aspect. We always say that getting advice when you're coming to a seminal point in your life, whether it's buying a business, selling a business, retiring, in this case, really important.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think people, like we talked about, spend a lot of time or more time on financial, on sort of logistical stuff. What's the date? Am I going to fully retire? Am I going to partially retire? The celebratory stuff, like my retirement party, but then they don't think about, okay,
what comes
on
the
Monday
day
I'm waking up and then I'm retired now.
All of a sudden, nobody wants to talk to you anymore because...
For those of us that have been in political life, that you see that the day after you're no longer in office.
Exactly. But,
listen, we really appreciate you coming in. We've been joined by Teresa Norris-Liu. She is Vice President of Pension and Retirement Consulting at Cowan Insurance Group. Out of time, Greg.
I know. We have on December the 5th, we have our annual mayor's breakfast. And this year we've got our own mayor, Catherine McGarry, of course. And we have the mayor of London, Ed Holder.
We have our Christmas business after 5. It's at Waterloo Region Police Service headquarters. And we're doing it in partnership to highlight Special Olympics Ontario. And that's coming in the spring. And Chief Larkin will be there, the Codfather. Don't want to miss it. And we have our holiday open house at the Chamber. The dates escape me right now, so go to Chamber, greaterkwchamber.com and look at our events page, or go to cambridgechamber.com for all information. We'll be back next week with another edition of Business to Business on 570 News, powered by Cowan Insurance.